Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Oren Etzioni to the broadcast. Oren is the Chief Executive Officer of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, a role he's held since 2014. The mission of the Institute is to contribute to humanity through high-impact AI research and engineering. The goal of Oren's research is to solve fundamental problems in AI, particularly the automatic learning of knowledge from text. Oren has been a professor at the University of Washington's Computer Science Department since 1991, and he's also been a founder or co-founder of multiple companies, including Faircast, which was sold to Microsoft in 2008, and Decide, which was sold to eBay in 2013, among others. Oren received his bachelor's degree in computer science from Harvard and his master's and PhD in computer science from Carnegie Mellon. I recently caught up with Oren in his office in Seattle, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed the potential job displacement that could be caused by artificial intelligence and the role that government may play in cushioning that eventuality. Principle 2, infrastructure, as we discussed security and his perspective on the dangers of artificial intelligence that have been expressed by thought leaders, including Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking. We also discussed advice for enterprises considering the use of AI, methods he uses to stay on top of current technology trends, some promising future developments within the field of AI, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Oren Etzioni, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. Oren, you are the CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. I wonder if we could begin with sort of a description of the organization. I've read that the mission of the Allen Institute for AI is to contribute to humanity through high-impact AI research and engineering. I wonder at a minimum if you could help define or provide your definition for high-impact AI research and engineering.
Sure. Well, it really starts with Paul Allen, who is a visionary and scientific philanthropist. He won the Carnegie Medal for philanthropy last year. And in fact, just yesterday, there was an announcement in D.C. of another $100 million Frontiers program in bioscience that was done at the National Academy. So he really has a broad picture. And part of that, he's been passionate for decades about AI research and the potential of AI to benefit humanity. But back in January 2014, we were launched as a nonprofit research institute in Seattle. We're now 50 people, about half PhDs, half engineers. And the question that we ask ourselves when we get up in the morning is, okay, what can we do using these techniques? And ultimately, to me, the computer is just a big pencil. So what can we sketch using this pencil that makes a positive difference to society and that advances the state of the art, hopefully in an outsized way? We're small compared to the teams that Google and Facebook and others have, but we want to, if you will, punch above our weight class. And if you like, I can describe a specific project that illustrates this.
I would love to hear that. Please do.
One of the things we've noticed as we've developed expertise in natural language processing and machine learning is that there are no Renaissance men and women anymore, if you will. The number of scientific papers out there feeds 100 million. There are millions published every year, and nobody can keep up. So what's happened in scientific research is Google Scholar came on the scene about a decade ago and made all these papers, indexed them, made them quickly accessible for simple queries. But the problem has now become that there's just too much, right? You do a simple query and you experience overload. So what we need are techniques to help people cut through the clutter and home in on key results. So the question becomes, how do we do that? And the approach that we've taken is to use AI methods to filter irrelevant results, to extract key information like the topic of the paper, the figures that are involved, the citations that are influential, et cetera, et cetera. All this in order to help people find the papers that they really need, needle in a haystack type of thing. And we've launched a free service on the internet called SemanticsScholar.org. Currently, it indexes several million computer science papers, so it's really only a service for computer scientists, but we hope to expand it. In fact, we're expanding it in 2016 to neuroscience, and we hope to expand it to the additional set of sciences over time. But most importantly, this is our poster child, because you see us using cutting-edge techniques to do something that's not going to make us any money, right? Scientific search is not a moneymaker, but hopefully will help humanity by having scientists be more effective at their job.
Understood. So essentially, you're kind of the facilitators. I'm way oversimplifying here, but as you say, there's not a commercial end to this, but rather you're hoping to make the lives and the work of others much easier and better and more fulfilling as a result of the work that you're doing. Is that a fair synopsis?
That's exactly right. And specifically, I mean, there's so many people one could help. We're focused on scientists here. And so our hypothesis, if we can make scientists better at their job, then we can help solve some of humanity's thorniest problems. We're starting with computer scientists, but where we really want to go in the next few years is to medical researchers and ultimately doctors, right? Because even when you go to see a specialist, that he or she does not have the latest information about your condition. They just can't keep up. And so they're diagnosing you and treating you based on, at best, incomplete and potentially erroneous information. And we want to help change that.
As you think of, and I don't know what sort of a time horizon you typically think about, but if you were to think about the next decade, let's say, what are some of the promising future attributes or outcomes that you foresee with the developments that are coming down the pipeline and with regard to AI, generally speaking? You talked about healthcare, for instance, and one would imagine that some of those advances actually may lead directly to people living lives longer, for instance, and better as a result of that.
So it's really the case that AI is becoming pervasive in its use in technology and society. You know, Mark Andreessen famously said that software is eating the world. And one might riff on that and say, well, AI is eating software in the sense that everywhere where there's a software solution, there's the potential for an AI solution. You know, and of course, cars is a great example of that. So if you look at cars, the cars have become basically, complex computers, right? There's more than 150 CPUs, computers in the average car. But there's the potential now to have the car drive itself using AI. And the reason that's exciting is, A, it could reduce the number of accidents we have on the roads today, right? 30,000 accidents on today's highways, 30,000 fatalities, many more accidents, and often due to distracted human drivers or humans driving under the influence. So we could reduce that. Our highways and our roads are underutilized because of the allowances we have to make for human drivers. We could pack the roads more densely and reduce, traffic congestion and greenhouse gases and all those things if traffic were more efficient. So that's a great example. But really, anywhere you look in society, I see the potential for AI to help.
I read a paper of yours from a number of months back in Backchannel, as I recall, where you were saying, and I quote you here, "The popular dystopian vision of AI is wrong for one simple reason. It equates intelligence with autonomy." And I wonder if you could unpack that insight a little bit. I thought that was particularly interesting and seems to be the basis of a lot of, optimism, but perhaps also the counterbalance to some of the pessimism with regard to advances in AI.
Yeah, well, thank you. I do think that's an important point. And in fact, let me illustrate in the context of cars, as we were just talking about that. People refer to these cars as autonomous cars. But of course, they're not autonomous in the traditional sense. They will drive us to where we want to go, but they don't choose where to go. And it's not like 100 cars will suddenly band together and decide to, you know, to storm town hall. The notions of autonomy here are either non-existent or very, very limited, right? If you have automatic transmission in your car or, you know, anti-lock brake, is that a safety device, an efficiency device to reduce the load on the human driver, or is that somehow autonomous transmission? So what we've really seen in AI is rapid advances in limited arenas in the intelligence of the tools that we use, whether it's a Go playing program or elements of a car, but not really in their autonomy, right? These things are still very much controlled by the person. And, you know, AlphaGo, which recently beat the world champion in Go, didn't know it won. It didn't choose to play. It didn't, you know, celebrate after it won. It's really just a tool that was actually, you know, engineered by a set of people. So I think that in people, intelligence and autonomy naturally go hand in hand. But in fact, those are two very different notions. And what we're in the process of developing is intelligent software. And I think it's important to put it to good use, as I was talking about, but not autonomous software. Let me just give one example where I think autonomy would actually be devastating, which is people are studying and potentially developing, I'm not an expert on this, but autonomous weapon systems, where more and more, you know, the weapon could on its own decide to target somebody and actually pull the trigger. And that, I think, is extremely alarming. We don't want AI systems to be making these life or death decisions. We want AI systems to remain under the control of people.
Interesting point. There are obviously a lot of people who are cautious. I shouldn't say pessimistic, because they certainly are also putting a lot of time, attention, and money into the development of AI. But I think of Elon Musk or Stephen Hawking or Nick Bostrom as people who are sounding the alarm, so to speak, a little bit about the safety concerns of AI. And I wonder about your perspectives on that.
Well, the biggest note of caution that I have has to do with the impact on jobs. So I think people have talked about AI being an existential risk, and Elon Musk said, you know, with AI we're unleashing the demon, which is, you know, very religious imagery. And I don't think that that's based in fact. I think, in fact, we see that the systems, as I said, they're limited. They're kind of intelligent savants, right? They're limited to these very narrow tasks. They don't have a degree of autonomy. Nevertheless, we've also been seeing, particularly on the border between AI systems and what's called big data systems and just digital and computer technology in general, we have been seeing impacts on the labor force, and there's been discussion that this could accelerate. And I do think that there's a potential, if this hasn't already happened, for great disruption in the labor force, and that's something that we need to think about very carefully. Basically, if we do have these self-driving cars, how does that impact, you know, the 10% or so of the labor force who are working in transportation? As clerical jobs are lost, where do these people make their living? What is the impact on the income distribution in society? Those are really, really important questions, and we started discussing those. I was on a panel in the AAAI, the, you know, National Association, a panel on AI and labor, and there was general agreement amongst the panelists that a major disruption is coming, right? We can't exactly tell when and how big, and we need to start thinking about it now.
What do you think? I mean, do you have any thoughts about the notion of job displacement and the role of government, for instance, in helping ensure that the landing is a little softer for those who are impacted most? You mentioned some of the categories that are likely to be greatly impacted by innovations that are, by most educated guesses, only a few years away, and in some cases even coming closer than that, perhaps.
So once we've acknowledged that there's a problem here, and it's a very serious problem for a lot of people, sometimes people are dismissive and say, oh, look, we went through the Industrial Revolution and it worked out fine. But I don't believe that, because maybe it worked out fine in the long term, but in the short term, my understanding of the history is that it was extremely disruptive to a lot of people, and we don't want to be heartless about that. So if we acknowledge that there's a very real problem, next question is, where is the solution going to come from? And I think the solution is not technological in the sense of, oh, well, if we just did AI right, it would work out. And I don't think the solution is regulatory. Oh, well, let's just regulate AI. Let's tax it or something. Because again, if we slow ourselves down, what happens, you know, with other countries, right? They speed up and so on and so on. I think the solution, as you alluded to, is policies that ultimately come from the government. And people have talked about universal basic income. People have talked about negative income tax. There are various mechanisms that are, you know, training programs, better education. I think there are many mechanisms that we can employ to help people deal with this change effectively, and we need to analyze those programs, identify the ones that are to be most effective, and put them into place. And the time to engage in that process is now.
I'm curious, given the pace of change, what are the methods that you use to remain current? Obviously, you mentioned you've got a team of 50, half PhDs, half engineers. I have to imagine those are a very smart group of people who are autodidacts and probably form a strong core of the people who keep you up to date just as you do them. But I'm also curious what sort of diet you maintain, so to speak, in terms of what you read, who you listen to, those sorts of things.
First of all, you're absolutely right. One of my favorite sayings is, much have I learned from my teachers, but even more from my friends and even more from my students. And so it is very much the case that these younger folks who are at the cutting edge, and you know, we have a very vibrant intern program, they come in and they're constantly teaching us what's the latest in this super fast moving field. The second thing that I use is tools, specifically Semantic Scholar, because the amount of relevant information thrown at us, whether it's tweets, and often people are tweeting about scientific results in my Twitter sphere, tweets, papers, studies, is just staggering. And so you need tools to help you figure out what to read, what not to read. Is there a way to summarize it, jump into the right table with the key result, find surveys and so on? So I get most of my information from technical papers, and then, of course, from talking to these super talented folks on our team, and also, of course, dialoguing externally. So we're a small team. Science, as you know, is a very social enterprise. We're constantly having meetings and hallway conversations, and that's because that's a very efficient way to share information and refine our ideas.
What role, you mentioned at the outset, for good reason, the Institute is named for Paul Allen. What role does he play on a day-to-day or month-to-month basis?
So one of the amazing things to me has been just how engaged, given that he does have a few things on his plate, like the Seahawks and a space program and basketball team and various museums and additional institutes, the brain science, he's created one in cell science. He is remarkably engaged. He came and spent the day at our scientific advisory board meeting, and I think he enjoyed it for the same reason that I did, which is talking to about the latest and greatest with the smartest folks in the field. So he's very engaged, you know, via email, in person. He sits on our board as well. And, you know, he is remarkably intellectually ambitious. He's always challenging us to not just think about, you know, the next step forward, but to think further ahead. Where can we have a major impact?
And who are some of the organizations that you partner with? As you mentioned, you are going to grossly generalize here, but developing work that will facilitate and advance the work of others. And I wonder, you know, who are some of the organizations that you're currently partnering with, and what are some further examples of the benefits that have been garnered through those partnerships?
We've funded research at the University of Washington, at Northwestern, at several universities, and we've collaborated with them, and that's led to papers and data sets that we, again, being a nonprofit, we publish our data on our website so that people can use it and go forward. Let me describe to you actually one of the most exciting engagement initiatives that we've had. So as we talked about, there's some confusion about what AI can and can't do, and so to rationalize that discussion, we took eighth grade science questions and we challenged the community at large. We announced a competition on the website Kaggle.com to see whose program can do the best eighth grade science questions. And again, there's thousands of training questions given to the program. And then once the program has been refined, people submitted and they tried on unseen questions, right? Test questions, kind of like when a child or an adult sits down to do a test and they see the questions for the first time. And so literally thousands of teams participated through Kaggle. And we announced the winners back in February, and they shared, you know, the approaches that they took. But to me, the most interesting thing was no one was able to do better than 60%, you know, teams all over the world on eighth grade science questions, because it turns out that those questions are sufficiently complex and require the application of ideas to real world situations, require common sense knowledge, you know, questions like if you have a marble in a glass of water and the marble drops to the bottom of the glass, what force caused that, right? And the answer is gravity, but you not only have to understand what gravity is, you have to understand how to apply that concept to everyday objects. So it turns out that those types of questions are very difficult for the machine, and we validated that hypothesis and learned how to do better on it through this kind of crowdsourced collaboration with all these different teams.
Can you tell me, how do you think about the potential for the power of AI for the enterprise versus the individual? Or do you see those as two of the same thing?
Obviously, the enterprise does have somewhat different requirements. Generally, people are expecting more industrial-grade, bulletproof systems, you know, running more reliably at higher scales. That said, the problems are the same. If you're able to talk to a consumer the way Alexa does, surely there's, you know, correlates for that in the enterprise. And, you know, again, one of these potential disruptors, not everybody has the budget so that every worker in the enterprise has a highly capable personal assistant, right? Only a few of us are sufficiently privileged. Well, once we have programs that can do that, everybody can afford to have an assistant, and, you know, little things like scheduling a meeting become a lot more efficient, because instead of, you know, my assistant will talk to your assistant, or I'll talk to you and we'll exchange a bunch of emails, and maybe there's five of us trying to schedule a meeting, our software will do that just as seamlessly as sending an email or sending an Outlook invitation. The whole little dance of scheduling can be done automatically.
You have quite a track record as an entrepreneur. The companies that you've founded or co-founded include Metacrawler, NetBot, ClearForest, Faircast, Decide, and each of these had successful exits, so to speak, that is, purchased by major organizations. I wonder, who were the people who influenced you most as you thought about becoming an entrepreneur? And I wonder as you reflect back on your career, what some of the essential ingredients were for you to become one?
The interesting thing is that I've always wanted to have an impact. I think that's one of the reasons why the invitation from Paul Allen to head this institute that he was forming was so attractive, because I felt like our interests are aligned, right? He doesn't want to just, you know, create a retirement home for academics, or, you know, have a place to write even more of these scientific papers. You know, we have so many of them, but really to have an impact. And so to me, having done the early part of my career as a professor, I felt like, okay, I have an impact educating people. That was very enjoyable teaching, and I had an impact mentoring grad students, and of course, in turn, being mentored by them, as we talked about earlier. And, you know, I had my chance to write papers, but I was hungry for having a more direct impact, right? Putting something in people's hands that they can actually use. And Metacrawler was kind of an experiment in that. We had an idea of how to build a better search engine back in the day. This is before Google, and search engines were kind of slow and only covered a very small fraction of the web. And so we built this program that queried multiple search engines simultaneously and called and presented the best results for people. So that was Metacrawler. And when I saw people using that, I realized that even for somebody who comes from an academic background, we have a chance to have a positive impact on the world by getting software out there into people's hands. And doing that does require a different system than a university system, right? University is not set up for that. You either need to license the software to a company, or you need to do a startup. And so I learned about that way. But if you look at all the companies and so on, the goal was to have a positive impact on the world, whether helping people buy airline tickets more efficiently as airfares fluctuate, that was Faircast, protecting consumers from buying an iPad 2 just as the iPad 3 was about to come out, that was Decide.com. I was always trying to help consumers. We also had NetBot was the first comparison shopping company. We realized that while comparison shopping can be quite tedious if you're driving from one furniture store to another, on the internet, you can automatically look at a bunch of different stores and see where can you get the best price on a computer or some such thing. So that was really the motivation. And at the same time, I have to admit that as I was engaged in that, I did find that it's surprisingly lucrative if you're doing well. And so I won't try to say, hey, I was just trying to do good. I came into it with trying to do good. I feel like we did do some good, but I feel very fortunate that some of those have gone reasonably well.
May I ask, I mean, there's so many of them. There are not a lot of entrepreneurs who can count as many successful companies to their name as you can. In each of those cases, how, and I'm sure it was different for each, but was it at the point at which the organization was purchased that you began to think about the next idea, or did you have like a new idea sort of rattling around in your brain even as you were working on the one prior?
First of all, I should point out that what's called, you know, being a serial entrepreneur is not as good as it sounds. If you look at somebody like Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, they're not a serial entrepreneur. They just founded one company. It just happened to be so much better than any of mine. They didn't need to find another one, or, you know, those are still running. So, again, I feel like my companies have had some modest success, and that's why I was a serial entrepreneur. I had to go back at that. That's point number one. Point number two, because through all of that career, I was still being a professor. The cadence was really every 7 years. You know, you can describe my entrepreneurial 7-year itch. So the first company was founded in 1996, then the next one was in 2003. That was the beginning of Faircast, and the next one was in 2010. So that was Decide.com. So really only with the Allen Institute did I leave the university, and for the first time, I found the mission that I wanted to engage in full-time, and this is this nonprofit scientific mission. So I've left the university. I'm now the CEO of this research institute, and for the first time in all these companies, I actually am running the company, and, you know, frankly, it's terrifying. It's complicated. It's not something that I've done before. In the past, I was the founder, you know, the chief visionary officer, if you will. I got the team together, but then I handed it off to professional management, and I would grouse and grumble when they made the mistakes. Now, for the first time, I'm making my own mistakes, which is both terrifying and refreshing at the same time.
Just in the past days, there was the great success of AlphaGo, defeating the international champion of Go, and it has been hailed as yet another sign, perhaps in the same lineage as IBM Watson beating the Jeopardy champions, and yet another example of artificial intelligence prevailing. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the significance of that, and whether or not this represents a new plateau reached for those who are looking for advances in AI.
I do think that AlphaGo winning is a tremendous technical achievement for the folks at, you know, Google DeepMind, both the researchers and engineers, and it is exciting, and it happened way ahead of quote-unquote schedule. You know, people were predicting it would take an additional 10 years or more for that to happen, just because there's so many possibilities in Go. There's 10 to the 170 games, you know, that's more than the estimated number of atoms in the universe, et cetera, et cetera. That said, I think it's also important to understand that Go, like chess, is a game, you know, it's black and white, there's a discrete number of moves, it's very clear whether you won or lost, and the problems that we face in real life are a lot more nuanced and ambiguous and complicated, and so we should not extrapolate from this tremendous technical achievement to seeing a lot of problems either in the enterprise or in natural language processing or in general AI. We won't see those being solved in a hurry. There's not going to be this kind of domino effect. Now that we've done Go, the rest is going to fall into place. We still have decades of very difficult fundamental problems to solve before we can achieve the kind of intelligence, the kind of artificial intelligence you see in the movies. And of course, hopefully it's not as evil as in something like the Terminator and so on. But we're still very far from that. We're building these savants. And I think that the most important thing for people to remember is that superhuman performance on one narrow task, like we've seen in Go, does not translate to strong performance even, let alone superhuman, in lots of other arenas. There's a lot of work tailoring the program to Go, and getting that program even to play other games is a challenge, let alone getting it to understand a single sentence.
For companies, large going concerns that are thinking about AI, I wonder what sort of recommendations you would have for them. This is such, as we've been talking about throughout the conversation, such a fast-moving field. It is focused in so many different areas. Perhaps focus is the wrong word then. It is, you know, disseminating across the landscape to solve a variety of problems like the ones that you've described. For an organization that may be on the lower rungs of contemplating use of AI within their own enterprise, is there advice you would give them as to how best to, and I realize this is very general and would be a more specific question if it were a specific executive at a specific company, but I wonder if there's advice you would offer just the same, more generally speaking, for those who might be listening.
Certainly the place where we've seen the most rapid and impressive progress is in what's called, you know, big data or data mining and deep learning and neural networks and AlphaGo are also part of that. And basically what that means is if you identify a distinction, and that can be are airfares going up or down, that can be is this email spam or not, that can be loan processing, is this person a good credit risk or not. If you identify a distinction like that and you have a lot of labeled data, right, all these previous Go games that were played and see which move worked and which move didn't. If you have those two elements, a clear distinction and lots of label training data, then you are in a position to use this incredibly versatile technology to automatically find the patterns and be able to make those decisions automatically in the future. So if an executive, even if they're not technical, has that intuition, then time to call in an expert and discuss. And again, it's not going to happen out of the box, but there's that potential. And with some hard work, a lot of hard work, frankly, that can result in a very pleasing outcome.
Well, Oren Etzioni, thank you again for a wonderful conversation and for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.